Okay, so let's get started just having a discussion. So Ginny and I are going to talk about kilonovae and the thermal power emission associated with neutron star mergers. And our goal here is to provoke discussion. So I'm going to start off giving some of the observational constraints, and then Ginny will talk about how the modeling works and where the uncertainties are. And so the idea is that hopefully there will be some audience feedback here, and not just from Juno.
I'll try to shut up. I would still have 10 anyway.
Okay. So the basic observations for the kilonova associated with GW17087 was that there was an optical infrared thermally powered transient that we call kilonova or macronova. And if you haven't looked at the data before, you can see this is starting the movie that'll start 1.5 days after the merger with the spectral energy distribution going from the optical out through the infrared. And
let's just run through it a few times here.
And so basically the first thing you should see is that there's very little information in the spectrum in a certain sense, because there are not strong spectral features unlike a typical supernova on these timescales. And as we just sort of fade away here, we'll come back, you can see a couple of important things develop. So one is that in the optical especially, but also in the infrared at early times, you don't really see strong individual spectral features. And in part, that's because there's extremely high velocities of the material, which smears everything out. And then Jane will talk about the applying features in just a bit. The other thing is by 1.5 to 2.5 days, the spectral energy distribution has sort of bifurcated into kind of an optical and a near-infrared component. And the optical component fades faster than the near-infrared component, just at a very qualitative level.
Yes. A question. So, Virginia, so for broadline 1Cs, for long gamma ray bursts, it's also fast ejecta.
Yes.
And you do see these broad features.
So and you do see these broad features, but you also have the synchrotron afterglow, which.
But at this, it's not yet, no. Right? This is at 1.5 days or whatever. It's not even.
Is your question just why we're able to do better spectral identification on one versus the other?
Yes.
I mean, I think one is we know what a slow broadline 1C looks like. We don't know what a slow kilonova looks like. Another one is you just have fewer lines present, so there are fewer strong features that can blend into each other and mess each other up.
No, I think that's huge, actually, because in the broadline 1Cs, the features we start seeing right away are identifiable calcium infrared triplet, oxygen 1, some iron lines, whereas here it's going to be everything all mixed together.
Sorry, you just said no one agreed with me, right? Or are we?
No, I said I agree with you.
Yeah, okay.
And then you said no again, like you agree with if Ron says no, he means yes.
I don't know if we're arguing.
We're not.
So for example, like on the very first blue one, is that, I mean, that looks like maybe a little bit of a bump near the peak. Is that nothing? Or
You see a bump near the peak?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, just,
yeah.
Like that?
Yeah. Is that anything or no?
Maybe. I
think it would be hard to say.
Yeah, you could probably speak a little bit more about how much we should trust any particular feature that shows.
Since I reduced these ones, we should raise all these.
Okay, so not to labor this, but like the purple one, the middle one.
These are real, and this is my Gemini data, but it also shows up in the X-Shooter data, which were taken simultaneously. The fact that there's a bump here at 1.05, 1.1 microns, there's a bump shoulder here, shoulder there, that's all real.
Okay, and do you know what it's from?
We'll show you the model. It's not an individual element. That's the thing. It's all blends. The opacity is all completely blended, which creates the interpretation. So I think we should actually just sort of go on here to sort of answer these questions. But the basic observations are it's very fast fading in the blue, but slower in the infrared. So if you try to fit a black body, which is a terrible assumption, but you know, it's kind of smoothish, you find that the color temperature asymptotes to something like 2500 Kelvin after a week. It's not a black body, but that's a very weird number for a transient. So for a normal supernova, the asymptotic color temperature is more around 5 or 6,000 Kelvin. And this reflects what the actual emission mechanisms are in the different objects. And the other thing is, if you just add up the luminosity, volumetric luminosity in the optical infrared component, you get some curve that looks like this. And you say, is it, if assuming that the bulk of the emission near the peak, or out here, is powered by radioactive decay of our process. These are the Metzger et al. 2010 lines for the energy input of our process material. 10 to the minus 2 solar masses, 10 to the minus 1, somewhere in the middle. And so that's basically where the origin of the statement that a few hundreds of a solar mass of our process material comes from. Because you have to power this transient on a time scale of several days. So where does this all come from?
Okay, yes. So that's, I guess, backing up a little bit, getting into the origin of the material that produces this thermal emission. Just wanted to show you this nice fake movie that I made a while ago. So, okay, obviously, you know, you start with the merger of a neutron star and a neutron star, or a neutron star and black hole. That's kind of qualitatively similar. I guess we haven't seen one, so it's hard to say for sure. But you know, we think a lot of the same processes are at play, although there will, of course, be subtle differences. Okay, so there are a couple of ways to get mass out of this system, right? We talk about like the neutron star being disrupted, but that can actually happen in at least three ways. So first of all, and I apologize to the people who are like really up on their numerical relativity simulations, because I selected these images because they kind of look nice and are illustrative, but they are not, you know, state of the art relative to how we actually think mass is ejected in this system. So suspend your disbelief and just listen to my words. Don't look too closely at the picture. But okay, so in theory, you can get some tidal shedding that happens of the neutron stars. So this is just a neutron star disrupting in the gravitational field of its companion neutron star or its companion black hole. And that's going to produce some very fast tidal tail emission. You can also get another form of dynamical ejecta in the event that your two component stars are both neutron stars. So that should happen when the two neutron stars crash together. And then you get some material that's sort of like squeezed out of the contact interface. And so that is, those are both referred to as dynamical ejecta. They're kind of unbound from the system immediately and able to move away from the central remnant. But you also get some material that hangs around in a disk. And then after the merger happens, like these oscillations of the neutron star can liberate further material. So you form an accretion disk. And a lot of the material of the accretion disk is going to accrete back onto the central remnant, but some of it can also be blown off as a disk wind. So I think what I just wanted to point out is that there are a couple of ways to get mass out of the system, and they turn out to have different nucleosynthetic properties, and as we'll see as we continue to talk about Kilinovi, that can translate into having different emission properties. So again, that's just these tidal tails. What I will call the dynamical squeezed ejecta, and then also there's wind from the disk.
So there are two ways of ejecting things that are dynamical and wind powered.
Dynamical and wind powered, but if you're thinking about the electromagnetic signal, it's very useful to distinguish between the two subtypes of dynamical ejecta. Okay. All right. So and then you know all of this is neutron-rich matter. It should undergo an R process. That is going to release energy that will observe as a light curve. And so that's going to produce the young counterpart that we saw at least once and hopefully we'll see many times in the future. Okay, so now we can answer the question, what do we get from observing these young counterparts beyond what we're able to get from the gravitational wave signal alone? So there were kind of three major things that I was able to think of. There are probably more. The first and least interesting to me, if I'm being honest, although like objectively important, just like, don't ask me to talk about anything else, I'm not the right person, is cosmology, right? So if you can get an EM counterpart and make a redshift measurement, that gives you an independent way to calculate the Hubble constant, which is very exciting, but not something I work on actively. The second thing is, it gives you a way to understand the origin of the R process elements. So these are these heavy elements that are nucleosynthesized in a very neutron-rich environment. You think neutron star and neutron star binary and neutron star black hole binary mergers are very promising candidates to produce, a substantial portion of the total inventory of the R process elements that we see in the universe, but we really don't have a way to get at the nucleosynthesis that happens post-merger from gravitational waves alone. So you really need electromagnetic emission to answer that question. And then the other kind of compelling thing that you can do is make constraints on the neutron star equation of state. So this is something Ben has thought a lot about, like how do you combine, and a lot of other people too probably, but I know you and Brian did a very recent paper on it. You know, how do you combine information from the electromagnetic signal and the gravitational wave signal to understand what the neutron star equation of state is? Right, and that's just because the total amount of material that you get out, as well as you know exactly how that material undergoes nucleosynthesis in the aftermath of the merger, depend both on the ingredients that you put in, so what the binary components that you're working with, but they also are mediated by the equation of state. So you know we can try to understand the prevalence of different ejecta components and how they compare to each other, and that should tell us something about the neutron star radius. And then the post-merger disk nucleosynthesis seems to be very sensitive to the lifetime of the central remnant or the nature of the central remnant, whether you have a you know an immediate collapse to a black hole or something that survives longer as a hypermassive neutron star. So if we can really understand eon counterparts and have a lot of confidence in the parameters that we're inferring from our observations, you know, because our models are so great, then we can get at some of these questions.
Okay. Yes. Well, why am I talking about your paper?
Well, it's your slide. That's fine.
This is very organized.
So I stood up in front of a bar full of people last night and assured them that the gold in their wedding rings was made near a neutron star. So I hope you.
I never. I would have advised you not to. So who are all these fancy people with gold in their wedding rings? okay. Sorry, let's, right. So, how do we get at the question of nucleosynthesis? Right now, we have one very blunt instrument and, you know, a couple of, we have a hammer and like we're trying to learn how to make scalpels. It's kind of how it works right now. So the tool that we have at our disposal currently is opacity. We think that we have a pretty good idea of how our process opacities should compare to the opacity of more familiar explosive radioactively powered systems like supernovae. Okay, so for anyone who is not an astronomer, opacity just measures how difficult it is for photons to diffuse through material. So a high opacity means it's harder for photons to get out, and then a lower opacity, you know, means the photons can break out more easily. So in supernova, like in kilonovae, in a lot of these systems, you have a lot of atoms around, and the primary source of opacity is bound opacity. So the temperatures are low enough that most of the material in the gas is mildly ionized, and so you still have a lot of bound electrons. And then, you know, photons are deflected or absorbed along as they make their way out of the ejecta. When they're absorbed by atoms, they're not energetic enough to ionize those atoms, but they do excite the electrons and the atoms to a higher energy level configuration, and then the atoms are going to de-excite eventually. The atoms or ions will de-excite, and the photon energy will be recovered, and the photons will be free to make their way out of the ejecta. Okay, so we do not have all of the atomic data that we would like to, you know, construct from experimental data alone the opacities that are relevant for our process gases, or really even for supernova gases. Like a lot of that is still kind of calculations that are calibrated to laboratory measurements. But we fortunately have made great strides in our ability to model atoms computationally. So that is how most of the groups that are thinking about opacities have been approaching this problem, right? We use atomic structure modeling to try to understand the different electronic configurations and their propensities to absorb atoms. And once we have that synthetic atomic data, we can construct these synthetic opacities. Okay, so this is actually a slightly different version of the plot that I usually show, so let me remind myself. okay, I think the key point is these are all, so I like to show a plot that shows the opacities that are due to individual ions, but this is showing an opacity due to, from different mixtures. So, let's see. So, okay, if we, again, just want to benchmark relative to things that we're pretty familiar with, we could ask, what is the opacity of supernovae? We know how supernovae evolve, so we can kind of understand kilonova opacities relative to those of supernovae. It's easy to understand how that electromagnetic emission is going to scale. Iron is what supplies, you know, the dominant line opacity for supernovae, so that's plotted in this kind of dark blue purple here. And then I guess just to sort of verify auto structure is the code that we use to calculate the synthetic opacities. So just to validate that this atomic structure modeling procedure is at least valid in a case where we think we understand the opacities pretty well, you know, we did a comparison here. But I think the more important than that, is just to note the gulf between supernova-like opacity and the opacity of our process material that contains at least some of the heavy lanthanides and actinides. So these are some of the, if you look at a periodic table, lanthanides and actinides fall in the bottom two rows. So these are, you know, the most structurally complex atomic species that exist in the periodic table, and because of that, there's just that many more ways to for these atoms to rearrange their electrons. So that corresponds to more energy levels, and that corresponds to more lines. So again, as long as you mix enough of this stuff into your R process gas, you get an opacity, particularly at the redder wavelengths, that is much, much higher than the opacities that you get in like a typical supernova composition.
Which goes back to Andrew's question earlier about why one broad line one sees, do you see these individual features? It's because even if we're made of a ball of pure iron, the electron scattering opacity establishes a continuum at wavelengths longer than, you know, something in the blue. Therefore, you can see individual spectral features above the continuum. Whereas here, the lanthanide opacity exceeds the continuum opacity throughout the entire window.
To get the levels that you show, what fraction of the by mass is actually in lanthanides?
Yeah, so I think this is from the earliest calculations that we did. I think we had about 10% lanthanide mass fraction for our process mixture. But actually, in the next slide, I'll show not opacity, but light curves and spectra and how they vary with the assumed lanthanide mass fraction.
Is that the same temperature?
This is, yes, I think, I don't remember what temperature and density we selected. I think it was like 10 to the negative 13.
The same for iron and?
Yes.
Well, so people kind of argue about the opacities, right? And
yeah,
people doing the calculations and then the observations, I guess. I have a question, maybe you're gonna get to this on the next slide, I'm just anxious. Do you think that the future observations of the kilonova type things will be the arbiters of those types of disputes, or is it actually a theory problem that will arbitrate that, or something all different altogether?
So feel free to jump in. I think it's iterative. I guess I think the point I'm trying to make with this slide is this versus this, that I believe is robust. But you know, if we go back to these kilonova spectra, and you know, someone wants to say like, oh, it's cesium-2, that I think we, you know, then I would, to confidently make that detection, you know, I would want to see that cesium-2 line in a lot more kilonovae. I would want to see if groups that are doing this atomic structure modeling are all converging and showing that, yes, you have this one uniquely powerful transition here, and we're all finding that it's due to cesium and not, you know, some other ion that's creeping in and polluting that area. And then, you know, there are at least a couple of people that are thinking about doing lanthanide spectroscopy in the lab, or I should say there is one person I know of. So I maybe, you know, if theory and observation can identify really promising candidates. I don't know a lot about how this atomic spectroscopy is done. I understand it's very technically challenging, so I don't think it's the sort of thing where we can just, you know, like, order up a spectrum of neodymium or something, but like, we can, you know, have a lot of confidence that we think we're honing in on something very promising. Like, it might be possible to try to collaborate also with atomic physicists and maybe make a measurement or something.
To follow up on your question though,
yeah,
in terms of the specific technical details about how you and Dan treated this versus say how Chris Fire and their group treated this, there's a question of the overall level of capacity, not the individual lines or specific compositions,
yes,
or whatever. So again, to repeat that question, is this something which you can judge based on for example, the rise time of the kilonova in the infrared, or is this something which is going to be a complex issue of theory, laboratory measurements, and so on?
Well, so I think what you're referring to is a difference in the algorithm that was used to calculate the opacity.
Yes.
So it's, yeah, it has to do with what you assume the effect of rapid expansion is on opacity, and like whether the solely of approximation and the expansion of opacity formalism, which is what Dan and I have tended to favor, is a valid approximation. I tend to think that it is. If you look at the line smearing approach that was advocated by the Los Alamos group, they predicted a much better overall opacity that was not really consistent with the signal that we saw.
You say better opacity.
I'm sorry, I mean a higher opacity.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Higher opacity overall.
Yeah.
Which leads to a better event.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so basically the Los Alamos predictions, yeah. They put out a lot of flux in mid-infrared rather than near optical.
That's kind of nice. So that means there's some observational handle. Like there is actually, like, so for example, if you imagine the type of observations that, you know, that we'll have from 2025 to 2030, then it does mean that, you know, sort of the balance of, you know, sort of red versus green versus blue kind of events will actually give a handle on that type of thing. So there are some observational handholds. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, to what degree is this like, it's just a super hard problem that we're waiting for some, you know, next gen type of innovation in atomic spectroscopy or in calculations or whatever, and what sense is this something that, like, you know, by the time I'm 50, we're gonna have an answer and like, that'll be cool. It seems like there are actually some handholds for my 50th birthday party. That's good. Like in the next 10 years.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, no.
I'm going.
You have to go. One down. I'll drive the rest of you from the road. Yeah, no, I think Juno makes a great point. It's, you know, it is difficult but not hopeless. Like, I wasn't around then, but I think I've heard someone say we are for kilonova where we were for supernovae, like in the 80s.
Are you done? I mean, sorry. I didn't want to interrupt.
Yeah,
just let me follow up.
I was just summarizing. I don't think it's impossible, and I don't think it's strictly theory. Like, I think eventually we'll get there. What do you think?
Yeah, I was just going to say that as the one observer in the room, I have much less confidence in the ability of the observations to settle these questions, mm-hmm. except for the sort of bulk things, like this issue about whether or not the flux is going on near infrared versus mid-infrared. Because whenever you see some discrepancy between the basic model and the data, well, you're just going to add another knob to the model, and it'll be hard to have an individual question. I think one thing that has some hope is if we do get late-time nebular spectroscopy from JWST or something going out into the near to mid-infrared, where the number density of lines drops, you might have a handle on actually seeing individually understandable spectral features, as opposed to a giant blend.
Mm-hmm. Is that going to be possible for 17817?
No.
But so you need one even closer.
Mm-hmm. No, you need a telescope in space. that's
right, no, but it'll still be there, right?
Yeah, but it'll
fade it.
Yeah.
Too much.
But an event
like? An event
like
17, yeah.
About the same distance.
Yeah, or even a little bit farther, because your JWST is just such a nice thing.
These are two questions that are somewhat unrelated. One is, can you give us very simple sense for what's the main challenge with doing this in the lab? It seems like the obvious thing to do.
Yeah.
It must be challenging.
I'm
curious as to why.
Do you know? I think part of it is just maintaining these atoms like in the appropriate state of ionization.
So temperature.
Yeah.
Isn't it also that there are such a spectacularly huge number of transitions
and
measuring
yeah.
them all?
Yeah, so I don't know if you're going to show you. I don't know if we have a plot later about
one of
this.
The other characteristic problems with all kinds of astrophysically interesting atomic spectroscopy is that if you make them in the lab, you get such a thermal distributions. And when you have an atom with many ions, then you often get a mix of many ions in the plasma.
Okay.
So it's hard to tell which line goes with which ion.
I hadn't realized
that's
that.
That's why For example, mid-ionization iron opacity is a real mess. Because you just make this slew of different ionization states. Looking at neutral iron is easy. Looking at helium-like iron is easy. But the middle.
Right, okay.
This would be worth the same.
And the less just
the, before we finish that thought, I don't know the exact numbers in your structure model, but the partially filled F-shell atoms in Bionite series have a very large number of levels. And in, I know the numbers for the Tanaka paper, but I don't know them for yours. It's in order, these simulated models have like 30,000 energy levels and 71 million watts.
Yeah, yeah,
71
right.
million watts.
Yeah. And so you can imagine.
Yeah, and then you know that answered my question.
You had mentioned earlier the prospect of web, perhaps getting lines in the farther into the infrared where there's something sparser. But is the atomic database up to the task?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so you can see, like, this is the calculation that we did of opacities with atomic databases, and it's fine. The problem is that it ends, right? So you're
that's
not
what I figured. So you may see individual lines, you just won't know what they are.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But I mean, that's better than right now. We're not seeing things, and we don't know what they are. you have one more.
What's the main reading, the boosted model?
Yeah, okay, so this is, and this is kind of slightly out of date now because we have a better way to handle this, but the atomic structure calculations are kind of time and labor intensive, and you know, there are 14 lanthanides and 14 actinides, although you don't probably make most of the actinides. So it was not of, it was not of interest to us to, like, you know, fiddle and do 14 models. Mm-hmm. So just all we did instead was say, you know, what if we calculate a couple of them, make sure we kind of understand the distribution, then we'll pick one that we think is typical of all the lanthanides, and we'll assume that all of the lanthanides contribute roughly an equal opacity. And this works if you assume that the Solovyov optical depths and the expansion opacity formalism is an appropriate way to do it, because in that limit, your opacity calculation is reduced to a counting problem, and what you really need to know are the number of strong lines that you have. So if you think that that regime applies, then if you say, you know, my neodymium looks like this, and I have 14 things that are roughly like neodymium, you just multiply it by 14. So that's why if you look at these carefully, you can see that it's really, it's just
shift.
Yeah, you're just shifting it up on a log plot. But since then, somehow the professor and not the grad student ended up doing a full suite of atomic structure calculations for, well, I guess we don't have all of the lanthanides and all of the actinides, but we have all of the lanthanides now. And so we have this more complete synthetic atomic data set. And so we're no longer in this regime. We can just use them all. But it turns out that, like, this wasn't so bad. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was a fun discussion about opacity, but we don't actually see opacity. What we see are light curves and spectra. So I just wanted to kind of, you know, translate the opacities that we've been talking about into the electromagnetic observables that we'll actually someday see again. Okay. Again, I'll just remind you that the really critical quantity here is, you know, how many lanthanides. And a lot of times we say lanthanides, and nuclear physicists don't like it because they say, what about the actinides? So lanthanides is shorthand for lanthanides and actinides, but it's, you know, how much of this high opacity material you're mixing into your R-process ejecta. So here I'm showing kind of four models, so photometric light curves and then spectral snapshots at 4.5 gaze. And the models have the same mass and velocity and density structure. The only thing that's changing is the composition, right? So, okay, no surprise, you know, when you mix more high opacity material into your gas, you have a higher opacity. It's harder for the photons to get out. Your light curves get longer and dimmer and more plateauy. Your spectra shift into the infrared. And, you know, the reasons for that are pretty simple if you think about it. So if you make it harder for photons to diffuse out, it takes them longer to get out, so it takes the light curve longer to peak.
photons are going to lose energy adiabatically in the optically thick period of the explosion, and they're still rattling around inside this opaque ejecta cloud. So when the light curve does peak, it's going to peak at a lower velocity. The adiabatic cooling is partly responsible for the shift into the infrared that we see, but that also just has to do with the extreme opacities that we see at the optical wavelengths. So a lot of times, you know, even though the opacity remains high out into the infrared, photons at least have a fighting chance of escaping at those wavelengths. So a lot of times, you know, they have to wait until they've like scattered or fluoresced or otherwise worked their way into these higher wavelengths, and then they're able to get out. So that effect, in addition to adiabatic cooling, is going to give you a redder spectrum as you increase your opacity by increasing your lanthanide content. Yes?
So then the, when it's lanthanide poor, then it's basically dominated by iron at some point, if you just keep lowering this?
Never dominated by iron, because you don't really make iron in the R process.
But for this calculation, you're assuming that the non-lanthanide R process has iron-like opacities, right?
Not for this calculation. So that was the case in 2013.
Yeah.
For these calculations, I think what we did was we tried to come up with a crude mixture of, so actually there is iron in here, because now I guess the next frontier of atomic structure modeling for use in R process calculations would be, okay, so if you guys know the periodic table. Maybe you don't. So, yeah, it looks roughly like this. Okay, right, so here are the lanthanides and actinides. And so these are definitely like. Okay, so we make these in neutron star mergers, and some of them are also S process elements, but we also make all of, you know, these lighter elements as well. And just because of atomic complexity arguments, you remember from chemistry, like the periodicity of the periodic table is derived from these atomic orbitals. And the size of the atomic orbitals sets the potential complexity of the atom. So, you know, we go from like not complex to a little more complex to these D block elements, which are very complex, and then we have the most complex elements here. What did I want to say about this? Right, so in addition to the lanthanides and actinides, in the R process, you also make this whole host of elements that have opacities that are probably comparable to iron, because they also have their valence electrons in an open D shell. But you cannot just go to your database and get, you know, like all of the lines that you need for tungsten. And again, like, we dragged our heels a lot to do it just for these elements, so it's going to take a while before I think everybody has like a full suite of synthetic atomic data for all of these elements. So what we did in the meantime is, you know, we took the species that we understand fairly well from looking at supernovae, and we just tried to map this more complex composition onto like titanium and vanadium and chromium and manganese, et cetera, et cetera.
Just to give an overview of the composition of this material.
Yes.
In the figures that you showed before, the highest lanthanide fraction is 10%, and then you went down to 10 to -5.
Right.
So what's the rest of the stuff? Is it mostly the third and fourth row or fifth row? Or?
Oh, yeah, okay. I wish I had an R process. There are peaks, and I know where they live in atomic mass space, and I don't know exactly how that do you have a
atomic mass space will do.
Okay, right. So you have you have a peak around 130. Ah, thank you.
But or is it safe to say you just take the solar R process relative abundances and then shift the lanthanides relative to the rest
So you weren't taking like R process trajectories from nuclear network calculations.
Okay,
sort of
seven, 10 to 40. Mm-hmm.
And there's a question here.
Yes, so can you go back to the light curve calculation?
Yeah.
So I think it's similar to the previous question, but after 10 days, like all the models seems to match. So I assume like there's some, you know, one species, radioactive species, like that's responsible for the light time.
No, so okay, the everything does start to merge at 10 days, but this is...
just one go and these lines here.
No. Okay, sure. Well, I'll skip back to that. spoiler alert. Right. This has to do with the fact that the way Sedona treats our processed radioactivity right now is not fully consistent with variants that we're assuming in the composition. So, right. What this is actually an effect of is everything becoming optically thin. So you're entering a regime where, you know, photons aren't really diffusing out anymore. You're just getting this thermal emission, and any heat that's deposited is immediately able to leak out of the ejecta cloud. And because all of these have the same mass, they are all releasing, you know, the same amount of radioactive energy. And you know, it also, like, thinking about it that way also makes sense. You know, it's like the two lowest opacity models are the two that merge quickest because they're the first two to emerge out of that diffusive regime. Okay, using the word regime a lot. Right, okay, and what Ryan was setting me up to talk about is, yes, that's actually an oversimplification because, you know, there's, well, there are, when we think about the R process, there are kind of two categories of complications that we need to think about. The first is that, okay, sorry, and these are, again, these are some R process final abundances, so this is showing abundance in terms of mass, but this is actually just serving as a proxy for different histories of radioactivity, right? If you end up with something different, that means if you turn back time and sort of rewind the tape, you started out with something different and you moved through a different path to get there, including different kinds of decays and an overall different pattern of heating. And there are two ways that you can end up getting this kind of variance. So the first is just because you're going to have different astrophysical conditions, right? So we might have like typical and less typical mergers, but we know that every neutron star merger is not going to be exactly the same, and that means every R process is not going to be exactly the same. And so, you know, this is kind of showing the effect of expansion time and then also the effect of early neutron richness on the kind of abundances you can get out. But you can see that you get either some mild or some severe variation there. So, you know, even if we had a perfect understanding of the R process and exactly how it works, because these systems are not totally uniform, we are going to get some variation.
There's one curve, most of the curves look qualitatively pretty similar, but there's one that's very different, the light blue.
Yes.
What's the difference between it and the others?
So this one starts from a place of being very neutron poor early on, and these, I think, were, I think these have, so YE is the number of protons per baryon, so the lower your YE is, the more neutrons you have, and that means it's easier to make heavy elements through the R process, because the R process synthesizes material through neutron capture. So that is just, the YE of 0.25 is kind of a threshold case. If you decrease your free neutrons beyond that point, perfect.
Yeah, so these are different plots from different groups showing basically the same thing, where I guess let's focus on Jonas and Luke's paper here. There's a bunch of stuff plotted on this one thing, but this black line is the lanthanide fraction as a function of YE. And you see there's a cliff right here at 0.23. So, you know, it's 10% or zero, effectively. Mm-hmm. And so that light blue line was at 0.25, which is just slightly above the threshold.
Yeah.
And these are other plots showing the same thing. As you just step through YE, you either have everything that is our process or nothing.
Can you go into a little bit more detail what you mean by variation astrophysical environment?
I can. Can I?
Yeah, when you get to
uncertainty. I have a terrible slide that I will try to illustrate that. Okay, so right.
But the other thing is, there's just a lot that we don't know about nuclear physics far from the Valley of Stability, which is, you know, where the R process happens. So these would be things like, you know, what are the masses of a lot of these nuclei that are involved in the R process? What are their neutron capture cross sections? We really should have done an R process introduction. I'm thinking now. But, you know, like if you build up heavy nuclei through successive neutron capture, you can imagine that the neutron capture cross section is incredibly important for understanding. And then beta decay rates, and, you know, like other decay rates. So this is, you know, again, this is just kind of showing you the effect of, like, let's take some different models we have for this unknown nuclear physics. How does that affect what we get out? And, you know, this, again, is going to affect your final abundances, but it's also going to affect the path by which you arrive to those final abundances, and that means you're going to have a different kind of radioactivity. So since we've skipped around a little bit, but since we've arrived here, And so the point was, in Sedona, we allow the composition to vary independent of the nuclear heating. We've adopted a fixed nuclear heating profile, and we just changed the composition. And a fully self-consistent treatment would say, you know, what is my composition? What heating rate does that correspond to? So that's actually something that I have been working on with some people who do these R-process network calculations. And, you know, we're trying to figure out, given these two kinds of uncertainties, what is the possible range of R-process heating we could get out? How are those decay profiles going to translate into, you know, actual thermal emission? And then, you know, our goal is to just kind of explore, you know, not the single light curve that you get, but what is the swath of light curves that we can get for a given, you know, choice of, like, mass and velocity, given all of these differences in our process heating. Okay. So we were here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Does everyone believe that if you have more lanthanides, you get a longer, dimmer, and better light? Okay, so if we're all on board with that, so again, I think I said earlier, you know, like, we have one blunt instrument right now to try to understand the composition. And in my opinion, like, this is it. What we can do is try to say, you know, does something look red or does something look blue? And that tells us, like, lots of lanthanides, not a lot of lanthanides. Okay, so sorry, Duncan, what was your question?
So if you go back to the uncertainties plot, so I think I noticed something that Julian did, that if you look at if you change the nucleus side of things, so the FRDM, WS, they're all different, like, neutron capture radius, that type of stuff.
Yes.
I mean, qualitatively it looks the same, but on the various astrophysical conditions, FRDM slow fast, you know, there's a much bigger variable, and the boiling is quite different. So just curious, what did you vary? What do you mean by variation astrophysical conditions?
Right, okay, yes. Okay, thank you. Sorry, I knew that it related to the next thing on our list to talk about, but I couldn't. So yeah, let's talk about where some of this variation in astrophysical conditions comes in. I think this is actually, like, the most confusing slide I've ever made. Please bear with me. I will say, I didn't get the job. So let's think about where these variations in astrophysics come into play. Are you all right? Again, going back to what we talked about quite a while ago now, but, you know, these are a couple of different, this is kind of a reworking of a plot Ryan shares a lot, and it's quite nice just for illustrating the different paths that you can have over the course of a merger. So, you know, depending on what we start out with, we're going to get different kinds of mass ejection. So you have this tidal disruption that's most important in the case of neutron star black hole mergers, assuming the black hole is not so massive that the neutron star just spirals into it without being disruptive. And this is probably pretty subdominant for the case of neutron star mergers, except in special cases. Then we have this dynamical squeezing, material, you know, getting shot out of the interface. In the case of neutron star, neutron star mergers, not obviously possible for a neutron star black hole. In both cases, we form a disk, but the central remnant around which you form the disk is, you know, for a neutron star black hole case, we obviously go straight to a black hole. For a neutron star case, we can have some neutron star central remnant that is going to, you know, survive some amount of time or possibly be infinitely stable. Okay, let's see. So, is there anything changed? Right. Okay, so where are there opportunities for weak interactions to come into play and change the astrophysical conditions? Also, let me just say, when I talk about astrophysical conditions, all of the complexities of the R process for the purposes of, you know, the kinds of parameter-space simulations that we want to run are kind of compactified into three parameters. So we talk about tau, the expansion timescale, entropy per baryon, and then, of course, YE, which is the initial neutron richness. So this just tells you how fast things are expanding. This entropy per baryon is really just a proxy for density. And then YE is the number of protons to baryons you have, like at the time that neutron capture starts to take over and drive the evolution of the composition. Okay, so, but really again, you know, the fundamental reaction of the R process is that you have neutrons being captured onto moderately heavy C nuclei. So all of this is just telling you, you know, either how easy it is to capture, well, how long neutron capture is viable, right? Because if you expand long enough, your densities drop too fast for neutron capture to be efficient. This one is really telling you how easy it is to construct your seed nuclei. So if you have a very high entropy, things are like rattling around all over the place, and it inhibits your production of seeds. And then this tells you, you know, how many building blocks you have. So anything that happens prior to the R process that affects these parameters is going to affect your ability to, you know, it's going to kind of affect the conditions on the ground when the R process starts, and it's going to affect what you get out. So the main places where weak interactions are important, you know, in this kind of storyboard here are, first of all, the material has been dynamically squeezed. So the tidal shredding, this is just kind of generically very like fast, neutron rich, and cold. There's not enough going on in the tidally shredded material for weak interactions to be important. But this, you know, you have two neutron stars slamming together, you drive a shock, the material is shock heated, it's very hot. So you have the thermal production of electron positron pairs, and then you can have some neutrino irradiation as well. And that is going to, that can, you know, change kind of all of these conditions. And then you can have the same thing happening in a disk. So in particular, in the case that you have a neutron star central remnant that survives for some time, not only do you have, you know, the same kind of thermal processes in the, because the disk is hot, you know, that you have in the case of a black hole central remnant, you also are going to have neutrino irradiation from this newly born hypermassive neutron star, and that's going to dump a lot of neutrinos in. And any kind of weak interactions in an environment where you're this neutron rich are going to generically favor protonization. So like, if they're operating, they're operating to raise your YE and make it harder to have a successful R process. So let's think about how that relates to equation of state.
Yeah, I was going to ask in this context, it seems to me that for the R process to work at all, there are probably fairly tight bounds on YE. Because basically, what you're doing, in a sense, is recapitulating the collapse that formed the neutron star in the first place, but doing so with possibly a different entropy. But you're reversing it.
Okay.
So when it gets to the neutron star state, then the degeneracy level of the neutrons is so high that it's all pure neutrons. Mm-hmm. Now, if you imagine expanding that to more ordinary densities, free neutrons decay in a few seconds.
Oh, so, right? They decay. Okay.
So there's And you just have more, you have much more normal events about it. So
yes.
To have, run the R process, you need to have the density below the neutron star level, but not terribly far below. And then there's a limited period of time if it's all expanding when yes. you'd be in that state. And I'm guessing that that would go along with, as I said, a fairly narrow range of possible YBs, because you're trapped in one extreme, the neutron star state, you're trapped in the other extreme, the half.
Yeah, I think that's just the wrong way to think about it.
Okay.
Because I think the thing about this is from a neutron star merger simulation from Stefan Rosvog's group, and this is showing the composition. And the thing is, basically, you have valley stability where you have stable nuclei. You have a whole bunch of neutron captures, which puts you up against the neutron drip line. And the neutron drip line is this line here where it's no longer energetically allowed to capture additional neutrons because they're free. And basically, the way it works is that because you're just constantly being pushed up against the neutron drip line, it's very robust, assuming that you have sufficient neutrons to continually push you up here until, as the entropy goes down, then you can decay backwards. So it ends up being very robust as long as you have enough neutrons.
Is that
okay, so what you're saying is that it hangs up at a particular Y equal Y.
Yeah.
As long as you have the other way of saying whatever, which is that there's a very narrow range of YEs you can have during the process.
Well, so as you've talked about, yeah, once you get to a Y of about 0.25, give or take.
Right, if you're below it, nothing happens. If you're way above it, nothing happens.
You're good. You're in good shape.
Yeah. It just when you crash above the 0.23.
Yeah. Well, I went to 0.23 with some plus minus.
Yeah, either you can push up against here or you don't. It's pretty binary. So there's a wide range of conditions under which this happens.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Back to this mess. Right, okay. So then just to think about how all of this relates to the neutron star equation of state, I think this is sort of, right. We were trying to convince you that electromagnetic observations could be useful for understanding the neutron star equation of state. So if we think about this not in terms of, if we kind of think about the relationship between neutron star equation of state and opportunities for weak interactions to change the outcome of the R process, thus affecting the opacity and the character of the outcoming electromagnetic emission, there are a couple of places where this shows up. If we're interested in tidally shredded material, right, the less compact of a neutron star you have, again, there's, the black hole is obviously important here because that's going to affect, whether the neutron star gets shredded at all. But if we assume that we have some disruption that happens, a less compact neutron star is easier for that black hole to shred. So a less compact equation of state is going to favor a more pronounced tidal component. In the case of dynamical squeezing, which again we think should have a less successful R process resulting in a lower lanthanide and actinide mass fraction and therefore more blue emission, this we're actually going to get more in the event that we have a more compact equation of state because the radii of the neutron stars will be smaller. They are going to be moving faster when they crash together, and that's going to create this more violent mass ejection. Although if you have a prompt collapse, you don't expect this component to be important at all. So there's kind of there's a limit to how compact you want to make your neutron stars if you're looking for dynamically squeezed ejecta. And then finally, the material that's surrounding the disk is going to be irradiated, by more neutrinos from the neutron star if the neutron star at the center survives longer. And that has to do with the maximum mass of a neutron star, and how long a hyper or supermassive neutron star can support itself against collapse via solid body or differential rotation. Okay. So, we kind of jumped around all out of order, but I think the point here is that if you believe
that red versus blue emission has something to do with the way, or with the, you know, the outcome of our process nucleosynthesis, then that gives you a very useful tool for, I guess, accessing a lot of interesting information about exactly what went on over the course of the project. Okay. So, and now I think we're going to move on and explicitly address some sources of research. What's up?
Yeah. You have something you want to share with the rest of the class?
Yeah, I'm still trying to understand
the
UI dependence. Mm-hmm. Because if it's true in the switch, because you have a saturation of neutron trail, then is the critical thing in determining how many R process nuclei you end up with the length of time the system has YE below the critical, and also a density low enough that the neutrons aren't all highly degenerate?
You mean a density high? Yeah, low. Yeah.
You've got to leave the neutron star state, and then you've got to sit there for a while with still relatively few free electrons.
Yes, yes.
And the R process takes place in the, those conditions.
Yeah, I think so. I guess I think the first, you might not want to think about it as like a perfectly smooth expansion, just because the energy that's liberated when you have this disruption of the neutron star material is enough to heat this gas to extremely high temperatures. So you'll pass like 10 to the 9 Kelvins. Mm-hmm. You go into NSE. right, so you kind of, you're like resetting your gas at that point, and at that point everything is just kind of determined by your temperature, your density, charge and mass conservation. You cool a little bit more, and that's when you start to build up your C nuclei. And then...
Right, and then you want to stay in that state. It's pushing more neutrons onto those nuclei.
No, well, so quasi-statistical equilibrium is when you build up your C nuclei, and then you expand a little, you have to expand a little further to enable the neutron capture to take over as the dominant.
And so what determines the fraction of very neutron-rich nuclei is then basically how much time you have to pack the neutrons into those atoms.
Yeah, well, so I think that's captured in this extension time scale.
And that's why, given the sort of essentially square wave dependence on YE, which I'm discussing, if I'm wondering whether the sort of initial value of YE will certainly tell you whether it happens at all, but then the amount you get, provided YE is small enough, would depend on the time that you are in that state in the R process, when you can actually run the R process mechanism.
So I think the neutron capture time scale is much faster than any dynamical time scale.
Thank you.
So,
yeah, I mean, this is less than a second.
So what exactly determines the global abundance of the R process materials, R process
material? So a lot of it has to do with
the nuclear physics.
You have this free parameter of way back when about the fraction of anti-atoms.
Yes.
And it ranged over a factor of 10 to the 4, the numbers that you
have. Yes.
So what determines whether you end up with that parameter being 10 minus 5 or 10 minus 4?
Yeah, I mean, so it's some interplay of things, and you know, you can access probably complex fluids that have.
I was going to say, I would say actually that for a single zone model, you're not going to end up with 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3, et cetera.
Sure.
You're going to end up with 10 to the minus 1 or 0.
Okay.
And so when she's saying that she's playing the light curves with this parameter and some intermediate value, we should take it as being a multi-component model that's mixed together somehow. Mm-hmm. And I think you were going to talk about the multiple components next.
Yes.
So that's the key. So it really is a specific prediction if you have homogeneous conditions, but homogeneous conditions are not entirely given.
But I also think, you know, when we talk about this, you may be giving us a little too much credit, Ryan, because, you know, like when we talk about this model,
You know, we are, well.
Yeah, so the way I think about it is that.
Basically, it's like how much of the ejecta reaches conditions where our process can occur.
Almost all of the ejecta undergoes an R process.
But it doesn't go all the way to the lanthanides.
Yeah.
And so I think Goni's right that it's the way I think about this, or at least the way I think about it, is you have some material that reaches full R process saturation, some material that doesn't, but you have different zones that then get ejected. And for the purposes of doing this calculation, it's as though it's all microscopically.
Yes.
Or
okay.
Microscopically.
Okay.
For whether you reach saturation is.
A combination of those three parameters.
Well, but you said the Y is basically a switch. It either runs or it doesn't.
It's probably an oversimplification.
Yes.
But you showed this curve, but they're really good.
Well, so, but that's not, that's again, that's.
So
I can show you other curves.
It does determine whether it gets to saturation.
The three parameters that Jenny has.
Okay, can you map that out?
Yes, those plots exist, and that's what the one plot I showed you from Lacuna and Roberts comes from, is basically doing a parameter search of all the possible combinations and seeing the output. So there's basically two ways about going about this effectiveness of neutron star merger simulation. One is to actually follow the actual trajectories of every little parcel of gas and what its initial entropy and YE are, and how that goes into the final abundances, and then trying to then take this and do the radio transfer. Or you can do a single zone model or a single composition model where you say, okay, we're just going to vary this one parameter here and say everything else washes out.
So to follow up on that, we were talking earlier about the prospect and observations. How red does it get? How long does it take to peak in the different wavelengths? Could distinguish between different microscopic treatments of the opacity, like the Sokolov approximation. But it sounds like there's another possibility, which is that maybe the higher opacities exist, it's just that you have a smaller fraction of lanthanides, or is that not a prospect?
Wait, are you saying very high opacity with a small fraction of lanthanides?
Lanthanide opacity with a lower mass fraction.
Yes.
I guess, because at a certain level, we're sensitive to what is the actual opacity, right?
Yes.
Centimeter squared per gram.
Right.
And
total,
so that's a product of, you know,
yeah.
Some differential thing.
Right. So if the opacity of the lanthanides is high, but the abundance of lanthanides is compensatingly low, then the full, would it be the case that the full development, especially in the infrared, would be what we see? Or is there some other way of distinguishing between?
So I think that might work in explaining the light curves. It would have problems explaining the wavelength dependence of the opacity to produce the spectra.
Uh-huh.
And I suspect there's probably some way to connect this all and make it a constraint, but I don't know that I would believe it at the current level.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have a...
Off the top of my head, I do not.
These are good questions, but should we move on here?
Yeah, I think I just wanted to make one point when you were talking about, you know, the mixture of like one zone models, you know, really representing. I just wanted to be clear, since we're moving on to talk about multiple components, I think we have to be careful in how we use the term components, because we're not, you know, when we say we think we have like 10 to the minus 4 lanthanide mass fraction, we're not talking of, and then we talk about that being a result of, you know, mixing different zones together. That's not the same. Those are not the components we're talking about when we're talking about like these. I don't know if I made it clearer, but.
Yeah. To say this again, we're going to talk about a blue component and a red component, and that's different than saying that there's pure microscopic mixing results.
Yes.
The microscopic mixing is microscopically different.
That's great.
So yeah, Jenny had the previous slide with all these various things that can happen, and the net effect is, it, since everything we see depends on the opacity, it matters whether the opacity is high or low, and that determines whether you're red or blue. And these are sort of the most common combinations of those, depending on how much disk wind you get versus how much dynamical ejecta versus if you go to a black hole immediately.
So as you can see, this is kind of a, well, we've been talking for more than an hour now, which is probably why we're really, okay, right. You can see that this is at least a somewhat asymmetric system, right? So the squeezed dynamical material is ejected preferentially towards the poles. Any tidal material, if it's there, is kind of concentrated around the equatorial plane. We get a little bit of a break with the disk wind because that's thought to be fairly isotropic. But you know, overall, these are not like nice spherical systems. And so that means that when we think about models and interpretations of observations, we have to be thinking about, you know, how the emission might vary with viewing angle. And it also means that when we think about modeling these systems, we have to think, you know, it's probably not good enough, even though that's what a fair number of groups have been doing, to just kind of take one-dimensional models for each component and sort of superpose them onto each other and say that, you know, the effect of both of them is the effect of one treated independently from the other. So we might actually need to think about reprocessing of radiation by...
Yeah, just because I think we skipped over a step in this logic chain here, which is to say that if you look at the observations of 170817, we require something that's relatively long-lived and infrared bright, but that model, or something that solely explains the infrared emission at late times, cannot explain the early time emission. And so that's where we're starting to say multiple components in this statement. So
yes,
we need a lower YE component in order to produce blue emission in the first couple of days.
Yeah, so I should
and so
say
that's why you have to talk about these cartoons,
right?
Blue and red.
Yeah, because I mean it's theoretically expected, but it was also observationally supported. So yes, okay. So right, we need to be thinking about the effects of multiple components, about a more complicated geometrical configuration, and then I think Ryan will probably talk about this more, but we also need to make sure when we look at a spectrum and we, you know, say we think this part of the spectrum corresponds to this, you know, piece of the kilonova, we want to be sure that we know what we're talking about and that we're actually doing a good job identifying each component and, you know, where it came from in this merger scenario.
Yeah, so in the initial round of papers, we took Jenny's and Dan's models, at, which were one-dimensional simulations with you know, fiducial kinetic energy profile, et cetera, and we pasted them together, simply adding a blue component plus a red component, which is equivalent to saying this is a cartoon where there's some solid angle which is red, some solid angle that's blue, and the two are just treated completely independently. But I think one of the frontiers is actually going to multiple dimensions in radiative transfer. And
yes.
Now you're working on it, it's not.
There it is, yes. Oh, I'm sorry, advertisement. I'm working on it with a great Barnard undergraduate who will be applying for grad school in the fall. So remember the name Margaret Smith.
Yeah, so this plot comes from, so there's kind of three different groups doing these sort of kilonova simulations,
yes.
Jenny and Dan, and then there's the Japanese group, and then the Los Alamos group. But this is from a paper by Kawaguchi about a two-dimensional model of a kilonova where they're trying to fit 170817. But the thing is that they're actually doing the radiative transfer in two dimensions. So rather than adding together, you know, a red component and a blue component, but they're allowing the radiation to affect each other. And because you have this opacity thing where if you have sufficiently high opacity, photons have trouble gain out in the red component, but they might go towards the low opacity blue component and then heat up that material and get out.
How much does viewing angle matter when you start looking at these simulations?
So this is their claim.
90 degrees?
Yeah.
The one you come at, that's 90 degrees when you're looking almost through the red component.
Yes.
The other one,
yes.
So it's a bit confusing, but you see, if you look at the lines, it goes from blue to red, that if you're looking in the equatorial plane, you have this opaque disk that's preventing you from seeing the blue component.
Right.
And so it's suppressed.
Right.
Although, so an interesting thing about both of these models is, so we talked about kind of the standard interpretation, sorry, I'm not trying to chase you off the foot. We talked about the standard interpretation of GW170817, which tended to be, you know, some kind of blue polar outflow, and then some kind of more spherical red disk wind. like this, both Pure Haze paper and then the Los Alamos paper inverted this, and they put a, they put a blue disc inside a red title tail. So, you know, this configuration is consistent with a scenario where you had title tail ejection concentrated in the equatorial plane, and then a blue disc outflow, possibly associated with a long-lived hypermassive neutron star. Although I think there's been some recent work on disc outflows showing that you can get neutrino radiation sufficient to turn your disc blue even in the absence of such a long-lived remnant. But so these are kind of, this is not only investigating the effect of multiple viewing angles, it's also kind of looking at a fundamentally different ejector configuration. And so it's interesting for that reason. And the motivation for doing this, oh, and I should say this is supported, you know, both by theoretical expectations and also by the velocities of the outflows that were inferred from looking at the width of spectral features. So the blue part of the spectrum, like Ryan showed earlier, was very smooth and featureless. And so that seems to require pretty high velocities on the order of a third of the speed of light to explain those outflow, or to explain, you know, those spectra, where the infrared part of the spectrum, although still very broad by like the standards of supernovae, was more like broad light 1c velocities, so more like a tenth of the speed of light. So that was, we really could have organized this better. But that, you know, that was part of the motivation for constructing, you know, a model that looks like this to explain the emission. And then this model, they're kind of making the argument that because of these radiation reprocessing effects, you can fool yourself into thinking you see fast blue material and slow red material when perhaps it's the inverse. But this was motivated by something, you know, we want to get to before we're out of time, which is the fact that the masses inferred from radiation comparison to radiation transport simulations for both of these components were sort of problem, well,
hard.
Were high, yes. So for the disk outflow, it was about maybe 0.3 solar masses, which is not kind of reasonable, but the blue was inferred to have a mass of about 0.01 solar masses, which is, you know, roughly an order of magnitude higher than what is expected based on numerical relativity simulations. So I think this was both a way to explore the effect of multiple components and multidimensionality and radiation reprocessing, but also just to try to resolve this tension of why do we have, you know, this massive blue component that's encompasses so much more mass than what we expected. Sorry.
Yeah, and so I just want to say this is important, and the claim, at least in the papers, then you can relax some of the, or lower slightly the inferred production value of our process, which is something people care about in this one event, you know, by tens of percent, not like orders of magnitude. Maybe I'll skip all this very quickly, but just to say there was some claims early on that, you know, you say you don't believe all these opacities because they're all fake, that the only thing you believe is the integrated gray opacity, bolometric light curve. And if you do that, you can actually find a pretty good fit with the Lanthanide abundance as 10⁻³, and thus that you can no longer explain the solar R process abundance as neutron star mergers. There's kind of two responses to that. One is to say you can't just ignore, say we know nothing about the opacity. The fact that this thing had a very weird spectral energy distribution means that its opacity cannot be made out of standard material. And the other is that this number is artificial when it comes to the R process, because again, it's based on YE, it's basically 0.1 or 0. It's very hard to make a single zone model that does 10⁻³.
Although, as you said, you're allowed to mix stuff.
You're allowed to mix, but if you're allowed to mix, then you have some R process material there. But I want to move on to say a little bit about the blue component. So there's one of the biggest mysteries after 17817 is what's going on the first day after the merger, because the thing that was seen was unusually bright and blue. And there are a bunch of different claims early on that that are slightly different. So there, Juna's gone, but Tony and Juna had a paper saying that the early time, first few days, was powered by shocks. There are also similar claims from Gottlieb and the Nakar folks saying the same thing, where they were then saying that it's not just powered by shocks. You imagine that you have this GRB jet, which we have not even talked about here, propagating through some ejected cloud, and you're going to form a cocoon emission because it's going to shock the material that's left behind, and some of that will produce blue light. So there's different flavors of this model, of these models, but the thing is with 17087, the first data points are basically half a day after the merger, and so we don't know, you know, how fast it rose, or if there were multiple things that were happening. And different people have some different models for this stuff, how it works. I would say I am not in favor of these shock models powering all the way up to 4 days. It requires very efficient energy deposition from the jet into the material. Paul Duffel has a paper doing more numerical simulations where he says it's very hard to actually couple the material because it's expanding. It's not just you're running a shock into the interstellar medium or something. You have an expanding ejected cloud that you're trying to ram into, and that makes it very hard to actually thermalize any emission in this cloud. And also part of this was trying to explain the whole GRB jet thing, like Andrew's already talked about, but by making it not a jet. But now we know there's a jet, so. I guess, were you all in Brian's paper here?
I was not involved in
Brian. Do you want to say anything about this?
Was
Ben, were you?
No, that was Todd.
Neither you or at all?
This is another hypothesis that Brian put forward. And I guess since I'm not super qualified to talk about all the details, but he proposed that, you know, you still have this low opacity ejecta, but that instead of being ejected dynamically, it was actually liberated by magnetized winds from a remnant hypermassive neutron star. And his argument is that, you know, that allows you to explain the higher masses, so it's not coming from this squeezed ejecta, it's actually, you know, this, we got the material right, but we got the origin wrong in, you know, the picture that I presented over there. So this is just, I guess, to show the diversity of theories that have been put forth to explain this very, you know, apparently massive outflow. So the interesting thing I think about both of these models is, like Ryan said, we didn't get a lot of information about the very earliest part of the kilonova signal. So a lot of the models that have been put forth, of course, can kind of explain the data that we do have, but they tend to diverge at earlier times. So if we're lucky enough to get another GW170817-like event, and we can really get on it earlier with electromagnetic follow-up, then we should be able to discriminate between some of these competing models.
Well, I mean, right, to some, that's true that we want earlier time to discriminate some things, but I think if you want to argue about the blue component mainly contributing to, I don't know, day, 2 day time scale emission, I would say that Paul Duffel's work shows that doing it with shock heating is basically impossible.
Yeah, and I wanted to point out this is because there was some confusion. So this is from Tony and Juna's paper. There was also Gottlieb et al. Have papers. They're actually physically very different assumptions that are going into these. And the Gottlieb model, it's sort of hidden on their plots, but even by half a day, where the first data point is, everything's powered by the kilonova, by radioactive decay. That even in their model, the cocoon emission is not contributing to the optical the first hour. So, as I meant, there's different assumptions about how this is all set up. We're getting towards the end, so let's talk about some of your...
Great, okay, so we can just,
Do you want to say anything quickly about the atomic data?
Yeah, it's uncertain, so. So, I mean, this is just showing, again, from uncertainties in one element, using one code to calculate the atomic data, you can see that you get a large difference in the opacities that you ultimately calculate. And then of course you have multiple groups, you know, doing their own calculations using kind of multiple methods and multiple codes. And so, you know, you get a lot of variation in opacity, and that of course translates to variation in the spectra that you get out. These are, this is at 2.5 days, just showing a Kilanova spectrum, you know, corresponding to these sort of three different versions of the calculation that we ran. And I think this is, you know, this just kind of gets at how complicated it's going to be, right? You can see that these all have roughly the same effective black body. So it's not like we get a spectrum that looks totally different and, you know, it's peaking out at, you know, 25,000 angstroms or, you know, 1,000 angstroms or something. They all have roughly the same character, but they have very different details. And then just given this level of uncertainty and given how many species there are contributing to the opacity, finding the needle in the haystack or the handful of needles in a haystack that are responsible for a particular feature in an observed spectrum, I think is very challenging, because you not only have to show that, you know, your favorite ion can do the job, you also have to show that there's nothing else that, you know, could do the job equally well.
And I think this connects back to Cole's question earlier. This one looks like the data. These don't.
Oh, and this one was from 2013.
The 2013 model has, you know, the peak at 1.05 microns, the shoulder at 1.2 microns, the dip, and a second thing at 1.6 microns, exactly like what we see. And these are very different and would be very obviously different in data. And so, you know how OP3 is different from OP2?
And it has to do with, you have some control over, like, whether you want to let the atomic structure calculation solve levels, or you can demand that it does its best to match to like known energy levels. So it just kind of has to do with how you optimize. I think opt stands for optimize. So it's the things that you choose to force your model to have the highest fidelity to. Okay, so I think we can skip over this because we mostly talked about it already. You know, something that is underexplored currently, in my opinion, is just the full variation of our process heating that you can get out. And fortunately, that's something that I'm working on. So.
And the last point I wanted to make, since we're running out of time, was we have N equals one kilonova, and the a priori models, coming from people like Jenny, worked extremely well predicting the infrared spectra, which is totally shocking, and actually worked far better than I thought it would. And I can give you some examples from the supernova literature where, you know, a priori supernova spectra would never look anything like the data. but I wanted to make one point, which is that we have other information about kilonovae from the short duration gamma ray bursts, which are also believed to be produced in mergers. We don't know if it's binary neutron stars, neutron star black holes. And you know, you have a gamma ray burst, which means you're looking down the axis or almost down the axis, and you have an optical afterglow, which makes it hard to search for kilonovae. But one thing that those of us who follow gamma ray bursts know is that there are short GRBs with counterparts fainter than 17817 at comparable optics. Whether it's non-detections by this compilation, you know, a magnitude or almost two magnitudes relative to 17817. And these are short duration gamma ray bursts, so you know you're looking down the axis. So the arguments we made about on the couple slides ago with the two-dimensional thing where the blue emission is suppressed if you're looking at the equatorial plane, here we know we're looking at pole long, so you should be able to see it. And so it may mean that there's actually a very wide range of outcomes in these merger simulations. That's one of the things I took away from 17817. Was it was a little bit brighter than expected, the R process mass was a little bit higher than expected, et cetera. If you try and extrapolate that to the full population of neutron star mergers, you end up with a little bit too much R process to explain the solar abundances and stuff. It makes a lot more sense that there's more objects out there where the R process production is significantly smaller.
So sorry, I'm not actually familiar with this paper. But did they show that do a comparison of like GRB energy or like anything about the GRB?
These are just based on the optical. These are just based on the optical afterglows. That the Troya paper makes a claim based on the gamma ray burst, actually saying that the gamma ray burst looked like 17817's gamma ray burst.
Okay.
Which we didn't even talk about here, but it's probably not it probably is a GRB, it's just not aimed at us, yeah. But we still see some gamma rays, which is a whole different question. It means that we're not looking down the barrel of the gun, but there is some relativistic material along our line of sight. Just to give you an idea here, this is one of the better sample on the multiple points. So this statement requires somebody has a non-detection at, you know, 3 days after the event that's faint or, you know, below the level of 17.17.
So people are about to get thrown out by the exostars people.
It's for the best.
Any last? Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for bearing with us.